The greatness of a man is most noticed in his absence. Who's going to miss you?
Previews of coming attractions.
Opening in theaters this week, there are two big releases. One's called Hostiles, stars Christian Bale and Wes Studi in a pretty serious-looking western about a U.S. Army veteran who agrees to escort a Cheyenne chief and his family through hostile territory in the 1890s. If the trailer's any indication, it seems to swing more in the direction of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven than, say, Kevin Costner's embarrassing white savior film Dances with Wolves. It even borrows a couple of memorable lines from Unforgiven in the trailer. I've always liked westerns, as long as you take them with a few more grains of salt, the older that they are. And I wouldn't mind seeing this one, but I don't feel very compelled by the trailer to see it on the big screen. The other new release is the third installment of the Maze Runner franchise, a trilogy which I suspect only exists because of the success of The Hunger Games. I saw the first and was underwhelmed, and I don't remember if I saw the second. I might be mixing it up in my mind with the equally forgettable Divergent series. So, if you're a huge Maze Runner fan and you've been dying to find out how it ends, I guess you should see this, but otherwise, I doubt that I'll ever watch it. In limited release this week, there is an interesting-looking Chinese animated film called Have a Nice Day that's getting a lot of comparisons to Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, which I guess means it's kind of derivative but still stylish and fun to watch. In the unlikely event that it makes it to my local Cineplex, I might check it out. Also in limited release, a pretty crazy-looking horror film called Like Me, about a teen girl who broadcasts a killing spree on social media. It's the feature debut of Robert Mockler, and if the trailer's any indication, it looks trippy as hell. Sadly, it's not playing anywhere near me, but if it does come here, I'll go. I should add that while I was checking my local listings for Like Me, I did notice that there is yet another sequel or remake of John Woo's A Better Tomorrow playing here in Halifax, so if you like Chinese action films, that might be worth a look. Finally, again in limited release, someone thought it would be a good idea to make a new kickboxer film starring stuntman-turned-actor Alain Moussy, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Christopher Lambert, Sam Medina, and Mike Tyson, of all people. It seems from the trailer that this film wants to be a kickboxing version of Creed, where the old champ comes out of retirement to train a new challenger, but I suspect the similarities end there. I do like martial arts pictures, so I might catch this on Netflix eventually, but otherwise, no thanks. And finally, new on Blu-ray this week is Geostorm, starring Gerard Butler, which I saw a preview screening of when it came out last year. My expectations were low then, and it did slightly exceed them. Also new this week is a picture called Jigsaw, which I guess is some kind of attempted reboot of the Saw franchise, and since I've only ever seen the first of those, it's unlikely I'll see this one. On the other hand, I would really like to see The Killing of a Sacred Deer, the new picture from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who made the indie hit film The Lobster. This one also stars Colin Farrell, along with Nicole Kidman and Alicia Silverstone, in what sounds like a disturbing picture about a man's perfect domestic life becoming unraveled. I missed it last year when it was at the film festival, so I'm looking forward to seeing it soon.
Previously, on Sunday Night in Cinema 3.
National Treasure Book of Secrets was the film that inspired the entire Cinema 3 project, as I went to see it during the holiday season of 2007, and was so depressed by the experience that I wondered if it would be more enjoyable to just show up at a random theater at the same time every week and see if I would enjoy whatever was playing. Spoiler alert, I usually didn't. And I really didn't enjoy having to watch it again only 4 weeks after seeing it for the first time. So perhaps it's not surprising that now, 10 years later, I didn't hate watching it quite as much. Don't get me wrong, I didn't like it. It is a terrible film. But perhaps seeing it 10 years ago was like a vaccination for watching it later in life. And for those keeping score, by the way, I have now seen National Treasure 2 3 times, while still having never seen National Treasure 1. You know what is a little surprising? National Treasure 2 was a huge success financially, making nearly $450 million worldwide in 2008. And Hollywood loves trilogies, so why hasn't there been a third one of these? Why has Nicolas Cage gone on to a series of largely forgettable action films, including completely unnecessary remakes of The Wicker Man and Left Behind? Again, don't get me wrong, I'm thrilled that there isn't a third National Treasure film. I'm just surprised that there isn't one. According to Wikipedia, there hasn't been a script good enough to greenlight yet, and I guess that could be true, but since when does that stop Disney? How many Pirates of the Caribbean films are there now? The casting of this film is an embarrassing group of overqualified people, including Harvey Keitel, Helen Mirren, Bruce Greenwood, Ty Burrell, John Voight, and Ed Harris, plus, of course, Nicolas Cage. Of all the incredible nonsense that this film asks us to believe, none is more incredible than the idea of Nicolas Cage as a respected historian. In this film, Cage is trying to clear the name of his great-great-grandfather, who Ed Harris claims was a conspirator in the Lincoln assassination. It's certainly not unusual for an action-adventure film to couch itself in history, but seeing this stuff about the Civil War now, with white supremacists currently in charge of the White House, is pretty unpleasant. But don't worry, because almost immediately after the setup, we get the unintentionally hilarious experience of watching Cage's Weasley tech support sidekick hack into Buckingham Palace security using an old iPod, a BlackBerry, a MacBook, and a sidekick phone. Cage screams gibberish in a terrible English accent to distract the guards. Cage later has a weird argument with a kid on the White House lawn that reminds me of a similar scene from Mitchell with Joe Don Baker. The screenplay, written by a husband and wife team called the Wibberleys, plus a couple of other hands, includes some lines that would be patently insane under normal circumstances, but when delivered by Nicolas Cage, you don't bat an eye. For example, "I'm going to kidnap the President of the United States." Sure, why not? The Wibberleys also wrote the story for Bad Boys 2, which makes National Treasure 2 look like The Godfather 2. And they co-wrote the screenplay for Charlie's Angels Full Throttle with John August, who wrote and directed The Nines, which I watched on DVD last week for Episode 3. Hollywood screenwriting is clearly a small, weird world. Ed Harris does deserve a special Oscar of some kind for elevating the script to the level of bearability. He is such a sympathetic bad guy that you actually want him to prevail. Diane Kruger, who plays the long-suffering love interest in both National Treasure films, is a German-born actress and model who just won the Best Actress Prize at Cannes for her German-language debut film called In the Fade. And Nick Cage, of course, is Nick Cage. As of this writing, he has made over 30 pictures since National Treasure 2. What can I say? The guy loves to work. I've enjoyed him in many films over the years, from Red Rock West to Leaving Las Vegas to more recent stuff like David Gordon Green's film Joe or Matthew Vaughn's first Kick-Ass. And he starred in David Lynch's underrated Wild at Heart. You have to give the guy credit for throwing himself headfirst into whatever he does, even if it's terrible.
Intermission.
So, the Oscar nominations were released this week, and between this year and last year's embarrassing mistake of nearly awarding Best Picture to La La Land over Moonlight, which I suspect was a manufactured mistake, we've seen the Academy make some substantial, albeit very late, efforts to be more inclusive about nominations. But let's not fool ourselves. While the creative side of Hollywood may be in the business to make projects that they're passionate about and which they see as works of art that could improve the lives of others, the business side is definitely in charge, greenlighting those projects, demanding compromises, and sometimes far worse from the talent. The Oscar telecast is a carefully scripted effort to marry art and commerce together, for Hollywood to remind the world that while they do make insanely expensive blockbuster films of dubious value, they also sometimes spend a tenth of a blockbuster's budget to make a film that tells the story of someone who we might find inspiring. As blockbusters get bigger in terms of budget and the all-important target audience, they also become more generic. Quick, which film was it where a multicultural and multigendered group of science heroes saved the world from a terrible extinction caused by a science villain? The Avengers? Fast and Furious 8? Geostorm? All of the above. The small, sensitively written indie films can also be very generic, unfortunately. They're more personal, but the lesson we're meant to take away from them is that we're lucky not to suffer the way that the disadvantaged hero of the sensitive indie film has suffered. And don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against tropes. All conventional storytelling is built on them. The excitement, for me at least, is in seeing something that does not feel like we've seen it before. Or, if we have seen it before, it might be updated for our times, and in so doing, it reveals a perspective on the material that we haven't previously seen. The obvious example of this year is the excellent film Get Out, which employs horror film tropes to create a contemporary fusion of conventional horror and biting social commentary. So why are we so invested in who wins these awards? And for that matter, why do we follow box office fortunes of films as if we were shareholders? I wish I knew. Everyone wants to be on the winning side, I suppose, and everyone wants to see the talent that they love and respect do well and be rewarded, and that's fair. Perhaps it's also partly an evolution of the celebrity-obsessed culture that we live in, where decades of reality TV and personal branding have convinced some of us that we're only a few likes away from being discovered. It's like buying lottery tickets, only instead of wasting your money, you waste your life.
And now, our feature presentation.
They shot a movie once in my hometown. Everybody was in it for miles around. Out at the Speedway, some kind of Elvis thing. Well, I ain't no movie star, but I can get behind anything. If you're Canadian like me, you probably instantly recognize those lyrics from one of the most popular songs ever recorded by the beloved rock band, The Tragically Hip, whose equally beloved lead singer and lyricist, Gord Downie, died of cancer last year. I was reminded of the song this week because the DVD that I'm looking at from my collection is a movie that was filmed in a city that may not exactly be my home, but I did live there for nearly 20 years, from the mid-90s to just a few years ago. The film was originally entitled Irish Eyes, and eventually called Vendetta, No Conscience, No Mercy, for the DVD release. And yes, I did work on the movie as an extra, though I did not manage to survive the cutting room floor, assuming that I was ever in the frame of a shot that got used. My friend Matt, who was part of an improv group that I joined in the early 2000s, recruited me for a couple of afternoons' work of standing around in the background dressed as a generic FBI agent. It was an interesting experience to see a film crew at work, even a small one like this. It was also where I met Brenda McLeese, who supplied costumes for this film and many others. And many other old friends and acquaintances from the St. John Theatre Company have speaking roles in the film. A couple of them have passed away since its release, so it was bittersweet to see them again on screen. The stars of Vendetta were Daniel Baldwin and John Novak as brothers Sean and Thomas, who take different paths in life after their dad is gunned down in front of them. In that sense, it's sort of like the movie Infernal Affairs, which I talked about in episode 2, but in this case, the hard-charging cop and the gang lord are related by blood. Baldwin, who is part of the great cast of David Simon's TV series Homicide, plays the bad brother, rising through the ranks of the Irish Mafia against the Boston-like backdrop of St. John's South End. Wings Hauser is also in the film as Baldwin's criminal mentor. Since this is probably the first time I've watched the film in at least a decade, I noticed a few other supporting actors that have gone on to greater fame since, most notably Tori Higginson, a Canadian actor who's all over the place, including a couple of the Stargate TV series, Aidan Devine, or perhaps that's Devine, my apologies if I got it wrong there, who recently appeared in Suicide Squad, lucky him, and Kevin Chapman, who played Fusco in Person of Interest, and is now appearing in the Amazon series Sneaky Pete. Apart from the cast, the first thing that I noticed about rewatching this film is how inconsistent it sometimes is in terms of its direction. It was clearly a low-budget picture that sometimes nonetheless looks very polished, with impressive photography, and then there are times when you see a boom mic drop into a shot. I'm guessing that the writer and director, Daniel McCarthy, saw it as something of a passion project. His only other credit is Second Unit on an even more obscure film a few years later. Seeing the St. John locations did make me smile, even if sometimes it was because I saw stuff like a sign for Donairs in a shop window. McCarthy's limitations as a rookie screenwriter don't help the film either. Vendetta is a very linear story where you pretty much always know what's going to happen. That doesn't always have to be a bad thing. We always know that the Titanic is going to sink at the end of that movie, but in this case, the tension never quite gets a chance to really build. So, in the end, Vendetta is an underachieving, low-budget action picture with aspirations of being another Goodfellas. With a more seasoned hand behind the camera and on the script, perhaps it could have been a cult classic like The Boondock Saints. I will hang on to my DVD copy, if nothing else, as a memento of the friends who worked on it, especially the late Jamie Williams and Richard Roy, both of whom were mainstays of the St. John Theatre Company in the early 2000s. If you enjoy gangster pictures, I don't particularly, and if you want to watch a peculiar piece of Canadiana, I do recommend you check it out, if you can find it.
Roll the credits.
Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is produced, written, and recorded by Scott Marshall, that's me, with much appreciated help from Nicole Slip and the nice people at the Central Branch of the Halifax Public Library. Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is copyright 2018 by Scott Marshall, all rights reserved. Please send your feedback, questions, or concerns to Sunday Night in Cinema 3, that's the number 3, not the written out word 3, sundaynightincinema3@gmail.com or through social media. Visit sundaynightincinema3.com for our links to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and whatever other social media platforms I can stand to deal with. This podcast does not have any advertisements because I figure we all have enough advertising in our lives, but it does have some modest expenses. So if you'd like to support the podcast, you can check out my Patreon at patreon.com/scottmarshall. That's 2 T's, 2 L's. For as low as $1 a month, you will have exclusive benefits, including outtakes and bonus material from the podcast, a heads up on what's coming up from me, and access to other exclusive digital content that I haven't even thought of yet. The Patreon also has a community forum where you can talk to each other or ask me questions. And if you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you will receive regular packages of physical stuff from me in the mail, including comics, art prints, stickers, game prototypes, and whatever else I can think of to send. Whatever you do, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. See you next Sunday in Cinema 3.
Good night.